Hello and welcome to the Astana International Financial Center's Legal Tech Podcast with your host, Mark Beer.
It is an absolute pleasure to welcome Sophia Adams-Barty to the podcast today. Sophia has been described as an expert in public policy, an expert in regulation, and yet someone who doesn't like to follow rules. She sits very much at the intersection of policy, law, and technology, and is currently head of strategy and policy at Simmons Wavelengths. And before that, she was director of policy for the Law Society of England and Wales, where she spearheaded its legal innovation program whilst fighting to uphold the rule of law and increase access to justice. So, Sophia, you have been described as one of the world's leading and most innovative regulators in one of the world's leading and most innovative regulatory environments. And that is a marriage made in heaven. But not all regulators, legal regulators, I should say, have a reputation for innovation. Some of them have a reputation for quite the opposite, for, in a sense, jobs for the boys, maintaining the integrity of the existing system, not looking to change or to adapt. So tell me, what is your view of legal regulation? How should it be? And why do so many regulators around the world fall short of the innovation agenda?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me to join you on this podcast. It's brilliant to be here. And I'm looking forward to a really fun conversation and hopefully entertaining for everyone who's listening. So, okay, you're absolutely right. The regulatory spectrum is full of different approaches. And I think the one thing that people need to recognise, and this is relevant to legal regulation as it is for any other sector, is regulation is fundamentally grounded in the values of your society. It reflects, or if you are regulating well, it ought to reflect the values held within the democratic society. And what you want is regulation to keep pace. Now, there was a time when we had heavily regulated industries across all sectors, and that was because we were coming out of a post, certainly in Europe, coming out of a post-war era where we had huge amounts of nation rebuilding required to do. And then the balance between freedom of choice of the private sector and the necessity to create a nation of prosperity and opportunity was such that you needed a pretty heavy hand. And also, no doubt, influenced by the fact a lot of the main thrust of the economic engine, particularly in Western European democracies, was state-owned, those utilities and so on. So, and as you privatized out of that in the 80s, you see this tipping balance and neoclassical approach to regulation taking hold. And what sometimes you get is an idea that without being essentially grounded in understanding where society is traveling to and what and how its values are evolving, you can sometimes get this sort of very closeted regulatory approach. And that's sometimes what we see in certain countries, certain jurisdictions when it comes to legal innovation and legal regulation. Now, there are no doubt people listening to this will know one of the countries that most has very conservative with a little c approach to innovation and legal innovation and regulation is the US. And you would think cutting edge, home of Silicon Valley, you know, founders of things like the creation of the web in conjunction with others internationally, you know, Facebook phenomena, the whole sort of reimagining the economy through the guise of the fourth industrial revolution came out of this nation, yet still we have this very embedded unauthorized practice of the law type constraints. Now, don't forget though, fundamentally, and we're seeing it right now playing out in the presidential debates, still a fundamental, very conservative values held in many respects across the nation. And what regulation has done in this instance, I think in the US at least, has played to the asymmetry of power, right? So you described it as jobs for the boys and so on. Actually, where there is no real pressure to change and where the existing status quo works quite well for you, what is the impetus to change? Particularly if you've not got this massive groundswell of demand from society or customers and so on. Now, actually, I paint a pretty poor picture of the US, but it's really interesting to see that just only a few weeks ago, Utah announced its regulatory sandbox. There is move afoot. And why? Because it's being demanded. So sometimes people say regulation lags. Sometimes they say regulation can be ahead of the curve. And actually, this is just a syncing up. I imagine if you ask me this question in 10 years, I'd say actually most regulatory regimes have begun to liberalize, or at least have taken some really significant steps.
I mean, I saw a piece of research the other day that talked to the digitization of economies and the push of many economies to move into the World Economic Forum's what it describes as the fourth industrial revolution. And that digitization agenda, what it requires is a number of factors, but one of the things it requires is not having strong lobby groups, because strong lobby groups lobby for the status quo. They don't lobby for change, because change and innovation can lead to the, let's say, the incumbents being diminished and the newcomers being enhanced. And along with that, it needs regulatory models and policy decisions which promote innovation and to some extent, unpromote, if that's a word, those that are insisting on doing things as they've always done it. And how does that, from the point of view of the legal system, we know, don't we, that 95% of people with a serious legal issue do not use the courts. They do not go to the institution set up to help them. And 84% of people with a serious legal issue don't want to see a lawyer either. So our system is not providing what it should be doing for its citizens. We know it's not working, and yet we're not seeing, in a sense, regulators forcing lawyers to fill that justice chasm. And how is that going to change?
So, you know, you're right, which is, you know, the current system globally, I mean, Richard Susskind writes about this in his latest book, doesn't he? That the numbers of people who are disenfranchised from the legal system globally is bewildering, absolutely bewildering. So you have to ask yourself, well, what is the purpose of not just the court system? Because actually people don't want to use courts, not because they don't want to use, they just don't want to go to court. It's like saying, would you like to have surgery? No, I'd rather prevent the harm. I'd rather not end up in surgery. Can you tell me how to just get better? And I think, don't forget, most people only interact with legal problems, not out of choice, but out of a failure of some description. And they tend, and it tends to be, as we call it in the economic frame, stress purchase. Right? Even buying a house is a stress purchase for most people in the UK, at least. But they tend not to be things that you do very frequently. They tend to be things that are wrapped up in some negative thought. You want the least resistance to solving your problem. So getting to court isn't people's aims. They want redress. They want a solution. And what we want, therefore, are regulatory environments that allow those who want to supply legal services or support the supply of legal services, put it that way, to be able to do so as freely as possible, but with some measures of protection. And this is a thing where I think regulators are still learning and trying to understand what the appropriate balance is, because in the same way as we've seen in other sectors, where consumers are in this massive asymmetry of power and information, i.e. they have very little information about their rights, and the person giving them the information has all of that insight. You tend to find that markets where that asymmetry is significant, you tend to find they work less well for the consumer, unless there are standards applied to ensure that the consumer has either ex ante or ex post, ex ante being before the event protection, ex post being a way to seek redress should that fail. And given that people are tending to find themselves in these situations on matters that are really quite important, a divorce, selling your house, the biggest purchase you'll ever make in your life probably, a work problem, employment issues, for instance, they're really important nodes in a life journey. So you don't want a complete Wild West where anyone can sell anything and there's no quality assurance. That, I mean, I feel very strongly about consumer protection in those sorts of terms. but neither do you want such a stringent regulatory regime that it means that people can't innovate to deliver the kind of services that people want. So whether that be dispute resolution platforms or templated ways of engaging with landlords, for instance, being able to service people's needs and compartmentalize. And I think the legal profession and the regulators supporting or working in that context have yet to really strike the balance between what is the appropriate level of protection and redress and the need to really open up the market so people feel that they can innovate in this sector. What I would say, though, is in the UK, compared to most of the globe, we have one of the most liberal, one of the most liberal regulatory environments. And yet still, we don't have a flurry of what we might call consumer-facing solutions. And there is a couple of problems in that, data being one of them, but also the nature of purchasing behaviour. The high street, known face of a law firm, that incumbency of I am a regulated law firm, is still incredibly embedded in the purchasing behaviour of consumers on the high street. And I think that will take some time and people will look to the regulator for affirmation of safety to go elsewhere. And so I think there may be kind of a regulation plus model where you support a opening up of regulatory barriers or reducing the barriers to entry, but come with standards and expectations of trust marks and kite marks and those sorts of approaches that at least keep the threshold of quality at a level that people are willing to trust.
And how do you feel at the suggestion that we're at a stage now and readily available, we have technology which has been proven to be a better judge of recidivism than a judge. We have technology that can review contracts more accurately and faster than a human lawyer. And we've got technology which can deliver, albeit quite standard, but as you say, you know, there are some fairly standard problems in society, deliver advice at low or no cost. If we think about those scenarios, are we moving to a world of robotic lawyers and robotic judges, or do you see that lawyers will have a place? And if they do have a place, what does the lawyer of the future need to look like in order to succeed in a world where technology is becoming so much more powerful?
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because each of those examples have been well reported. But then when you dig beneath the surface, actually, there's a whole lot, even if the future is robot lawyers, I promise you, if you're a lawyer out there at the moment, it ain't anytime soon, because it's a long way off, genuinely, you know. And so a really good example of pet interest of mine is recidivism and the use of predictive analytics and machine learning and policing. And I ran a commission on this a year or so ago, and I will be soon publishing a contribution to a book on the matter. And actually, some have said that the algorithms can judge recidivism better than the judge. The only problem is both the algorithms and the judge are massively biased. Bad data in, bad data out. It's just you can't see the data inside the judge's head. I'm being probably very cruel to the judiciary here. But actually, the fundamental problem with many of the machine learning tools used in policing is they just use really bad data. And if you live in a society where we criminalize you because of the color of your skin, then guess what? The recidivism stats are going to tell you that you are likely to re-offend when purely based on old data, not on anything that you could really judge as being reliable. So anyone listening out there who's thinking that policing is a whole lot easier now, think again. But I would say, even in my work, now that I'm at Simmons Wavelength, and we're looking at this the interventions of and the intersection between policy, law, and technology, how do we bring the best of what's currently on the market to bear to legal problems? We can solve many of them quicker, but we can't solve them. And there's a really interesting distinction. we can't run an entire legal process without a lawyer. I can make it quicker, I can make it better, but I still need a lawyer somewhere, or let's just say a legally qualified individual, or someone who has insight to those issues at a skill level required by clients, to intervene at various points. So it might be in the triage bit. So what is scoping out what it is we should be looking at. We still need a sense of judgment on that, what is important, before we go looking for it. And then when you've done a niche, so if you're using just document extraction capabilities to make it quicker, you describe, you know, it's so much easier to read documents. Once the machine's read it, there's still a judgment to be made, which is if there's a whole set of documents, let's say it's a contract, it's a review of employment contracts, and we want to know how many of these employment contracts, this would be very relevant at the moment, sadly, because of COVID, how many of these employment contracts carry a kind of a goodbye bonus if we lay people off? Let's just imagine that that might exist. Once we know, once we've extracted and reviewed all of those contracts, which we do fairly quickly and regularly and with great accuracy, actually, with the tools that we have on our bench, there's still an answer that the lawyer and the client need to solve, which is, okay, now that we know the size and shape of the problem, what are we going to do about it? Unfortunately, our machine learning tools don't do that bit. And you know, I think it's really important. There's an anthropological aspect to this, which is in the same way as GM foods failed. So you'll GM crops failed. You remember when GM crops were first introduced into the UK very quickly, and people felt that they posed a great danger to our agriculture industry, and there was a huge backlash. And actually, our GM market in the UK has never really recovered from that, and is cited often as a great failure of PR, frankly. But actually, it wasn't just PR. It was what I might call the elasticity of permission. You want society to run with you at a pace where they are willing to accept. So if you move from what we currently have, which is heavily manual, very face-to-face, albeit virtual now, system, to one hugely automated with hardly any intervention, let's just take the example of criminal justice, for instance, where all decisions up to the final point are made by some intervention of technology. You run too fast towards that without the consent of your society. Actually, you break the system, you do more harm than good. And also, I would say, be careful at promising what technology is capable of doing today. Because what we also don't want to do is to undermine trust and confidence. Because actually, if you promise that it can do X and it just clearly isn't capable of doing that at the moment, you know, it's a bit like the boy that called Wolf a one too many times. I am sure that the technology will get better. And as we get closer to quantum computing, I think the power of the computing capability to really churn through some of these data heavy requirements will massively improve our ability to use technology positively in this sector. But it's a way off. We're pretty much in the foothills of exploring what's capable at the moment.
But with, I think, COVID comes, unfortunately, considerable backlogs into what is considered less essential elements of the judicial system. So civil claims, let's put as an example, civil claims. And at the same time, it's the heart of our economy. If you take the UK, 99.9% of registered businesses in the UK are SMEs. And they are the ones most affected. On average, they spend an hour and a half a day chasing debts. That's an hour and a half they could be productive. And I predict that's going to get worse. And most of those debts are coming from big businesses not wanting to pay small businesses because they know that small business won't go to court. So do you think that this period now is likely to engender a much greater acceleration of the willingness of society, of business, to use technology to solve their problems rather than relying on a system which in the past, as we said, only 5% want to use, but now is going to be, through no fault of its own, but is going to be slower and therefore perhaps more costly at a time when business needs it to be faster in order to collect on unpaid debt. So are we seeing, is this a point of inflection or is it just a blip on the radar?
I really hope it's a point of inflection. And I think it really is for two reasons. One, it's gone on long enough and will continue to go on long enough, I'm sadly going to predict, for it really to start to change people's norm behaviours. So even at its base level, the comfort zone of just operating digitally as we're doing now, and I live on a street where the average age is about 70 or 75. And in the first couple of weeks of COVID, we all knocked on one another's windows and taught, 80-year-olds how to load WhatsApp onto their phone through their windows. It was pretty comical, but also very heartwarming. And now they're very active, is what I would say. I won't tell you the latest messages, they're funny, is what I'd say. But that's a level of inclusion in the digital world that previously would probably have put 90% of my street into the more or less the digitally excluded group, not because they're poor, but because they just didn't, they might have had smartphones, they might have used email, but for everything else, their default was pick up the phone, write a letter, fill in a form, go in person. And that's been taken away from them. And they've been given a digital alternative, and they're now beginning to get used to it and to trust it, and therefore possibly to enjoy it more than they would have thought. And that's been a forcing mechanism that wouldn't have happened without COVID. And so I think that's a really positive direction of travel. We've brought people with us, hopefully. What I will say is if this street demographically was, economically was in a different set, actually maybe they wouldn't be quite so comfortable, right? So the most vulnerable may not even have the financial strength and freedom to choose to operate digitally. They might be even more excluded than they were before. So I do think there's a gap that we need to consider. Right. So I do think that at this base level, behaviour and norms have changed and can continue to change. And so, to your point, would people be more willing to now engage and look for redress in a legal system that was more digitally delivered? I think the answer has to be yes. And it's not just because they're more used to it. It's also, if you're in the SME sector, you are facing extinction. And maybe not the entire sector, but each business is going through what we call their extinction event. They never planned for their sales to plummet like they did. They never planned for their supply chain to be so patchy. They never planned for the economy to be so weak so quickly and for such a long period of time, because it's likely to continue as we come in and out of waves of COVID. And for each one of those, they have their backs up against the wall. And if in the old days there was a choice between do it the old way or do it slightly innovatively with this digital platform that you've never played with before, they might have gone for the comfort zone of doing it the old way. They don't have a choice now. It is absolutely anything that can help them find a solution to get their revenue in or to manage their supplies better, they have to be able to take it. And so I think, if I was in any of the sectors supporting the SME community, whether it be in government and MOJ, whether it be in organisations and companies or think tanks and consortia who are developing these sorts of capabilities around online dispute resolution, bringing something to market quickly that is simple to use and operates well, now is the moment to capitalize on that, because people are having to use it. And if you do it well and you gain their trust, there is likely to be a long-term buy-in and loyalty.
I want to pick up, if I may, on this point of extinction, because it isn't just SMEs that many feel are at a point of extinction, but it's also many law firms. There are some highly innovative law firms. An example may well be Simmons with its investment into Wavelength to create Simmons Wavelength, looking to the future, that synthesis of law and policy and technology. But they're few and far between. And there is a feeling that we've already lost, in certainly in the United Kingdom, our high street, the people offering legal aid to individuals who have nowhere else to turn. Maybe they can go to Citizens Advice, but there's also, I think, a feeling now that this crisis will lead to the failure of many, many law firms. They may call it a merger, they may call it, I don't know, but a real sense that this is not going to be good for lawyers. So when you look at it, both with your experience from a technology point of view, with your experience of fighting for the rule of law and access to justice, from your experience as a leading regulator, policymaker, and now in your experience in the private sector, what advice would you be giving law firms today in order to survive the next decade?
No, you know what, this is such a relevant question because you're absolutely right. The legal community is not immune to the same pressures that the rest of the economy is facing. And but what I would say, just like the John Lewis's and the Marks and Spencers, this isn't a new problem. This has simply hit the fast forward button. So I was saying 3 or 4 years ago when I published a report on the future of legal innovation, that, and I've been quoted many times, or at least people will have heard me say it, that unless law firms really get to grips with data as being their source of intelligence, with having a innovative approach to delivering solutions to problems, by which I mean outcomes focused and client-centric rather than lawyer-centric, process-focused, unless they are willing to rethink the whole structure of law firms, for instance, around partnerships, so as to free up ideas generation and so on, they would face an existential threat. It just in those, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, it feels so long ago now, doesn't it? But only 3 or 4 years ago, I would have said, that's like a 10-year time horizon problem, but you need to start planning now because it's going to take you 10 years to achieve change. Actually, in a matter of less than a year that we're now in, for COVID, we'll soon be coming up to November, which would have been the first date of the first reported cases in Wuhan. We've seen that fast forwarded and facing boards around the country as their top agenda item. So what's the advice? And it's the same advice for the high street as it is for the city firms, although then I might break down a little bit how the responses might change. The first thing is to be really clear what market you're servicing. So there's a basic business 101. And Julia Sulaski was famously quoted a while ago, wasn't she, as saying, pilots don't run airlines. I have so much time for Julia, great innovator in the legal field, but she has a point. If you don't have someone who really understands business strategy in your law firm, you're in trouble. Get someone, hire someone. Do an idiot's guide to business strategy. Just get the basic tenets of how you run a business. It's not. I remember we did a piece of work when I was at the Law Society and a bit of research. And the number of times people said to me, but I don't run a business, I run a law firm. I wanted to cry for them, really, which is in which case you're not going to survive. I'm not saying that you don't keep at your core your professionalism, that you don't hold dearly those principles of the rule of law, and that when people seek to undermine the rule of law or seek to undermine our liberties, that you don't fight for that as a lawyer. Because actually, I feel really deeply and strongly about that. But you still, to even be a positive force in society, you need to be profitable and exist. Profit with a purpose is totally viable, but you need to understand your purpose. You need a business strategy, and purpose is absolutely everything, from the big boys and girls to the small high street. If you do not understand your purpose, and by which I don't mean making money, if anyone's listening, making money is not a purpose. That's what you do that enables you to have a purpose. That's what you do in order to pay your people, to keep them in house and home. It's what you do to feed yourself and your family. But every organization, from the shoemaker to the law firm, to the people in Silicon Valley, they need to have a purpose which is beyond that. And that purpose ought to be connected with doing something positive for planet and people. Okay, hold that dear. And then think about how that relates to your own personal market. Whether you're in the high street in Cambridge or whether or not you're somewhere in the city, there is a sector of the market that you service and you need to understand their needs. Right now, business across the country is feeling the pain of COVID, and they have needs that you can help with, and you need to understand what those are. So I think purpose and understanding your business strategy comes first before you turn to the amazing world of innovation and technology, because that's when you reach for thinking about how you do things differently. Once you know what it is that you should be doing, then you ask yourself how it is that we would do that. And then don't, please, God, please don't go and just buy some stuff off of a software vendor. Biggest mistake. Please don't do that. Think about how you might change what you do currently to drive efficiencies and to drive better client experience. Because it's all about the client experience, always has been, is even more so now. And that's about rethinking processes, not doing things the way they've always been done. And because we've had this moment where people have had to really just stop and rethink and rebuild their methods, probably there's more fertile ground for those conversations. And then once you've figured that out, then you look at the tech stack and say, what technology is going to help us get there? And what do we already have? In the Microsoft suite alone, there's all sorts of tools that most people are not using. So you probably don't even have to spend tons and tons of money. So they're kind of my three-stage response. Know your purpose, understand how you're going to deliver it, and then purchase or buy in or look to solutions in the technology tech stack that could help you achieve those more equally and quickly. But I will probably add just a helping of pragmatism here. There was always going to be consolidation in the market, always was, both in the technology front. So if you're operating in a tech startup or something, that was ripe for consolidation. You know, however many contract review software providers there are out there, the market needs some consolidation there, but also within the traditional legal frame. I think some consolidation might not necessarily be avoidable at all, but thinking about how to consolidate might be a better way of managing the situation. I will make one call out though to legal aid, which is, it doesn't matter how smart your business strategy is, legal aid is for those who have absolutely no money at all, the most vulnerable in our society. They're never going to be able to afford paid for legal services, even if they are super, super cheap, because tends to be a form of intersectionality. They'll be excluded from society. They'll be the most at risk for all sorts of reasons. And the state has to think about its responsibilities here. And in you know, not so long ago, there was a wonderful documentary by Paul Johnson on Radio 4 looking at the austerity budget cuts. And even in that, very recent ministers have admitted that the cuts went too far. And I do think that a democratic society like ours, that prides itself on people having some protections for their basic rights, we really ought to think about how we can service those better and more efficiently, of course, using technology where we can. But it is not down to the high street to offer cheapest chips, because probably that is even outside of their buying power.
Sophia, that was enormously powerful, and the AIFC Advisory Council is all the better for your vision and your humanity. I love that description, focus on the purpose for the planet, for the people, and that will lead to profit. It's such a powerful explanation of the way in which all businesses should be operating, but particularly how law firms should be operating. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you today. I'm so pleased that the work that's going on now in the Astana International Financial Centre to create an ecosystem to support legal technology, to enhance access to justice, to improve the rule of law, to allow technology to deliver legal advice to those the poorest and most in need in societies around the world. I'm so pleased that you're part of that, and I've thoroughly enjoyed today. Thank you very much indeed for your time, for your wisdom, for your vision, and for your humility.
Well, thank you, Mark. Thank you so much for having me, and it was a pleasure, and it is absolutely a pleasure to be working with the AIFC, because I think there's something really important about leading and taking an opportunity to really think innovatively and bravely about how to actively shape the future rather than simply be a passenger in the journey.
This podcast is being produced by the Astana International Financial Centre and moderated by the chairman of the AIFC Law Tech Advisory Council, Mark Beer. Thank you very much for listening. If you would like to hear more information on the Astana International Financial Centre's Law Tech Advisory Council, please follow us on LinkedIn.